Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Tuesday, the 13th.
You seem to be suggesting that
there's some British person interrupting. Get her out of the room. Okay, we're all set. Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable. And we love the British. We just, you know, they have to know their time and place. That's all. Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable on this Tuesday morning. It's the 13th of April and what looks to be a very nice day. So I hope you enjoy it. And I hope we help you start it out in good fashion. Let me introduce the group to you. We'll also remind you how you can be a part of the program. And then we'll get started. Man, a lot of news. I sent a ton of stories to the group last night, and then I have two editions, so it's a lot of stuff to talk about, and we'll get to it all, or at least try to, in just a moment. Alan Chartok is here. I see him. He's right there. Good morning, sir. How are you?
I'm here. We had early morning meetings. You know, we're interviewing people who will be who have applied or are still applying for we've got a lot of them for the managerial position at the Lyndon Norris Auditorium. So, if you're out there and you're still interested and you're interested, we're talking to people now. So we're doing interviews, and that's what we had our early morning meeting on. And so, you're absolutely right. I can't just get my hands around what's going on, and we'll be talking about that today because of some of it is just so disgraceful.
Yeah, a lot going on, and we'll get to it. But good to see you. We'll go to Mike Spain, former Times Union Associate Editor. Good morning, Michael. How are you?
I'm great, and happy to be here today. Thank you.
It's good to have you aboard.
Hey, Mike, are you looking for another job right now?
I'm optimistic that you're filling this position, meaning that you're planning to open up a lot of public events as soon as it's ready. And you should go out and find someone who's good at that.
You know, Mike, nothing says retirement quite like running an entertainment arts venue.
Yeah, that says it all.
Sign you up. Let's see. J.P. Miller is in the house. Yay. Good morning, J.P. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me, Joe.
The newly vaccinated J.P. Miller, how are you?
I'm good. Yeah, I got the J&J vaccine yesterday.
Oh, Jesus. Are you all right?
I feel great. Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll get to that story.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. Okay. Rosemary Armeo is with us. Good morning, Rosemary. How are you?
Good. I'm good. Good morning.
Good morning to you. Thank you for being here. All right. Reminder, if you'd like to be a part of the program, it's very easy. Panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org, and we'd love to hear from you. Panel@WAMC.org. As I mentioned, two stories breaking overnight, of course, one being the violence that is happening in Minneapolis, and we'll get to that in a moment. I will begin with the story, which is the Johnson & Johnson vaccine story, which I find to be fascinating. The U.S. has called for a pause on the Johnson & Johnson vaccine after there have been several cases, six, I believe, of clotting. Federal health officials called for the pause after six women developed rare blood clots. Nearly 7 million people in the United States have received the shot so far, one being our own J.P. Miller. Did you know, you didn't know about this going in yesterday, right, J.P.?
No, I did not.
Okay.
And may I just point out, you know, this is apparently something that happens more to women than
right,
to men.
Right, exactly. So, but it's one and done. And J.P., you can tell me to stop asking you questions at any time. But if this story had broken yesterday, would you still have gone and gotten the shot?
Well, I wouldn't have been able to because I don't think they're going to be administering the shots today.
Okay,
right?
But let's assume. That's a good point. Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
But I don't. But I would say that I do not regret taking it.
That's a great way of putting it. Ever the newsman. Excellent. All right. So, what do you make of this, Alan?
Who, me?
Yeah.
Well, there's a couple of complications here. The first is that we were being told by everybody that it was okay. And it got its emergency license to do this thing, and And of course, you know, despite the fact that a lot of people are in controlled trials, you never really, really know about the whole thing until that moment comes when everybody starts to get it. We've seen this time and again. I feel badly about the JP thing because we love him. And he is a huge part of what we do here. And we can't do without him. So, JP, I'm glad you're going to be okay.
But, now, So let me ask a question. Mike Spain, I'll put this to you, which is you give, you know, every time if you watch television for more than 20 minutes, you're going to see an ad for some sort of prescription drug. And they show you biking and hiking and playing with your dog. And, oh, by the way, you may have heart disease, a rash, or you could die. So we all know that there are risks. So we look at 7 million people that have received the shot so far in a relatively short period of time, to be sure. And I'm not making light of it. But you have six issues. One resulted in death, another one in critical condition. So I'm not questioning the thought of pausing it, but I'm just saying that we are looking at very small numbers of issues here, right?
I completely agree. It's fewer than one in a million who have experienced these problems. Wow. And when you think about it, it's really important for the federal government to do its due diligence now and kind of try to keep and restore public confidence in Johnson & Johnson and in vaccines in general. I mean, as a one-dose vaccine, it's easily stored and transported, which makes it an important component to get the vaccine out to rural areas and reach people they might not be able to reach with the other two, a Moderna and the Pfizer vaccines. And sadly, there were people who were already hesitant about vaccinations, and this will make it even more a challenge to convince them to get the jabs. And I'm happy that you got it, JP. I'm happy you're doing well. You'll monitor your health, and statistically, you're much better off than those people who take those drugs that they advertise on the morning TV
right.
news every day.
Yeah. For such horrible ailments as toenail fungus. Rosemary Armeo.
Yeah, I have that.
I do, too. And I was thinking about taking the pill until, they tell you you can either have toenail fungus or you could die. And I thought, I could deal with the toenail fungus, I guess.
As you know, Joe, very, very quickly, as you know, I am. I love Gunsmoke.
Yes.
The program.
Yeah.
And I think that they have figured that the old, I'm not going to tell you that Matt Dillon used this stuff. No, I'm not. But they know who is the demographic that's listening. And if you're old, they give you a lot of the stuff you're talking about.
A lot of medicine, a lot of reverse mortgages, and those little carts that bring you around.
That's right.
Yeah, the motorized scooters.
Right. I just want to point that out. We're going to go to Rosemary, though.
Yeah, Rosemary, I was thinking of you as this story was breaking this morning because, we've been talking a lot about people and dealing with people who say, this stuff hasn't been tested. I don't want to get a vaccine. And now you have a story like this, which certainly doesn't help matters.
Yeah, I think you guys are all sounding like a bunch of Dr. Fauci, be calm institutionalists. I think it's really scary. I have a friend who just got the Johnson & Johnson 2 weeks ago, and suddenly there are red marks on his arm that we thought were just old age. Now I've got, I want him to go see a doctor about it. I think it's really scary, and I do think that it hurts Pfizer and Moderna as well as Johnson & Johnson because it does lend credence to the idea. Yes, I know it's only six people. I heard everything you said and all of that, makes sense to your head, but not to your heart. If you're scared to begin with, it's really scary stuff. It's very, very bad news, just like AstraZeneca and now this. And we know that those drugs, the vaccines were rushed through because of an emergency. That means less testing, less assurance than we've had with vaccines in the past. I think this is a really big blow.
So when you look at it, though, and you say, okay, one of the things, Alan, that concerns me about this is that you have the numbers of the projections. We'd been up to however many 5-6 million people that we could vaccinate at a time in a day,
yeah.
And we were doing great. There have been supply problems with Johnson & Johnson over the last several weeks. And along with that comes now this, where it's on pause. So all of these numbers that we had of appointments that people had were based on the fact that we had this third vaccine, and now we don't, and that seems to be something that should be of great concern.
Well, I think so. I mean, I know it would be with me. You may remember on this very program that I was terribly beaten up when I had reservations about Johnson & Johnson. Because they were at the time being at 60% effective,
right,
or something like that. And the others were in the 90s. And people called up and said, you're a fool. And, you know, that may have been true. But
well, meaning, and your point being, if you have a choice between 90 to 95% effective versus 60 to 65% effective, well, sign me up for the 90 to 95.
Yes. And what Rosemary might point out, and I think would be quite called for in this case, my objections were not to, you know, the idea that somebody was going to get a blood clot, because I didn't know about it at the time. I was just talking about, you know, how effective these were. You know, all of us make up our minds based on, you know, things that are correct and also a lot of things that aren't correct. But as I think Mike pointed out, we do know that very few people are going to get this blood clot. What did he say? 1 in 1 million.
That's pretty low. Numbers. Yeah, that's as of the numbers now. I mean, the one thing, and to I guess to Rosemary, to your point, I think is that we haven't been giving this shot nearly as long as the others. We don't know as much.
Yeah, that's true, and I with others agree that it is not optimal that the testing is being done in a real life situation. I do understand that the pandemic has made that kind of imperative, but it's still scary. It's still very frightening, and I don't have to like it, even if intellectually I know it's required. And I have to say, I'm really glad I didn't get Johnson & Johnson. I know you don't have a choice about it, but I was really happy not to get it.
Well, is that right?
you also say a chance of a blood clot of 1 in 1 million. There have been 6 reported cases. Now that this is going to be the top news story on the planet today, you're going to see a lot more people reporting cases. I have a good friend of mine who had something similar happen to him because of the Pfizer vaccine, and the doctor
right.
said, "Well, it wasn't, you know, wasn't because of the Pfizer vaccine, but you might see people like that reporting those cases." And there is already mistrust, and now there are going to be all these reported cases. Is the United States going to now come back and say, you know what, everybody can take the Johnson & Johnson. We only have 100 or 200 cases of the clotting out of 7 or 8 million vaccines given. I find it hard to imagine that they're going to now bring back the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. And for people that took the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, they know what it's like now for those attendees at Woodstock who, you know, they're there on a Saturday afternoon and they took the brown acid to have some fun. And then the guy on stage comes up and says, "Hey, don't take the brown acid." And you say, well, I just took it. What do I do now?
That is an amazing comparison, JP.
And you look at the Empire Page report, you know, and every day JP will be on top of that. I know that.
Now, so JP, am I hearing you correctly, though? So you're thinking that they're going to take the vaccine away and not bring it back?
Can you imagine them saying, you know what, it's fine. It only happened in whatever the number of cases it is. You know, I don't see it happening. And also, people, you know, the vaccine has been around. People have had an opportunity, at least from my perspective. Most people have had an opportunity to get the vaccine now. The people that haven't have some distrust for some reason.
Yeah.
And now that distrust is just going to grow. You know, from my standpoint, I'm happy I took it. I don't regret it. But I found the single shot vaccine appealing. I also saw Governor Cuomo and de Blasio both take the J&J vaccine. And I said, boy, you know, if it's good enough for Cuomo and de Blasio, these guys talk to the top health experts in the world, why not take it? And for them to now take it off the shelves and essentially ban it, I can't imagine them bringing it back. But I could be wrong. You know, I'm obviously not a health expert.
Another thing to blame on Cuomo.
But Mike, we also saw this with AstraZeneca. I mean, they're still dealing with this. The United States said, hey, we have shots for Mexico and Canada. And then all these reports came out and Canada said, thank you, America, but we don't want AstraZeneca shots.
Well, I think, Rosemary, I agree with you that it's a emotional response, not an intellectual response, because what is the risk of getting the COVID disease and be seriously ill versus the risk of having an after effect of one of the vaccinations? And I think scientifically they would say it's a much better idea to take the risk and get the vaccination than it is to risk getting COVID, because it might kill you or cause long-term health problems, or you might spread it to somebody else who might die. You know, I mean, but
yeah,
that's,
and
that's,
all of that is, you just turned it into a math problem, you know, which is a bigger risk.
I
and
agree.
The truth is, yeah.
Go ahead, Rosemary.
Well, the truth is you're going to say, I don't want a shot that could hurt me. I'll just stay home and wear a mask and continue the way I am. At least I didn't get sick in the past year, and I'll continue on that way. That would be my emotional response if that were indeed the only vaccine.
But it isn't. And one of the things, we're short on time, we have to go to a break. One of the things I'd like to talk about when we get back is there's a fascinating article in the Times this morning with Johnson & Johnson, that they're trying the question of this waiting 3 to 4 weeks for your next shot with the two doses. Is it better to get more people one shot? Because right now, most of the vaccines are going to people to get their second shot. So when we come back, we'll talk about that and that conundrum and question that is being dealt with in the scientific world. And we'll welcome your letters on all of this. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Mike Spain, and J.P. Miller will be back right after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this morning. Alan Chartok, Mike Spain, J.P. Miller. Did I say your name, Alan?
Yes. Oh, okay, yes. Definitely.
Alan,
definitely did.
Alan, Rosemary, Mike, and J.P. I lost track somewhere in the middle of that very small list.
I always listen for that because it's my favorite time.
Only four names, and sometimes I miss them. I was really bad about saying the rosary. Or the litany. Yeah, it was the litany I got in trouble with. The story I wanted to talk about that I mentioned earlier is that, this idea that when you have, right now, you are opening up so that pretty much everyone 16 and above in most states can get the shot. So that's good. The problem is that so many of the shots that are available are rightfully, I mean, they were scheduled to go to people who are to get the second jab. And what is happening is there is a discussion in the scientific community. Well, is it a good idea to, given that the testing was based on 3 or 4 weeks, is it a good idea maybe to see if it can wait? And then that way you can get more people the first vaccine and then have them get the second vaccine. So the U.S. is choosing to give millions of people a second shot while making millions of others wait for their first. That's happening even though a single shot provides a high degree of protection. And even as a more severe contagious coronavirus variant is sweeping the country, but both cases and hospitalizations have risen in recent days and deaths have stopped declining. So that's the issue. Meanwhile, you have Dr. Fauci talking about following the science and saying his concern is that you let these that if you do that and in the time no longer 4 weeks, maybe 8, maybe 12, that you have the variants can run rampant. And that is of concern. So questions this morning about that and as to what makes the most sense. Britain has been dealing with this. The biggest worry about a longer delay between shots is that it may allow the new variant to develop in people. So we saw this in Britain, and there is real-world evidence showing large benefits, however, from maximizing the number of people who got one shot. Britain and the U.S. have now given a roughly similar number of total shots per capita. The difference is that Britain has deliberately delayed second shots up to 12 weeks, and the results are impressive, according to scientists. So with that information, Alan, how do you feel about that?
I really don't know. I mean, you know, I had both shots and got through it and felt good about that. I want to ask a question. There are so many, it seems to me, you know, we could build an airplane in a day in World War II. we could build a battleship in, you know, a couple of months. What is it that means that we can't get the vaccines that we know are working produced and set up a supply chain that will allow us to have everybody get the two shots, which is what they say is best for us? So, you know, I think that if this country wanted to, I can't assume anything else, they could make the vaccine and make sure that everybody got it who wanted it. So that's where I am.
Rosemary.
You know, this is like when you go to the dentist and he says, well, you can do this or you can do that. Neither choice is either really good or promises results, and then you have to pick. Why are we talking about this on a public affairs show? I want the doctors to tell us what's the best thing. I think it's a crapshoot. We don't know. And neither system has worked. Britain certainly isn't a model for anything. They've had terrible results. Their economy has been shut down longer than anybody else's. And I sort of think if you don't really know, stay the course. And so give people the second dose, that variant stuff, if it really took hold, could wipe out even the gains we've made with the people vaccinated so far. But what do I know? I'm just a plebe here. I would really like someone in charge to say, this is what we're going to do and why we're going to do it.
So do you think there's a lack of that leadership? I mean, we seem to have it better than we've certainly had it in a long time. But and this is a new problem, especially that's one that's going to be exacerbated by the Johnson & Johnson pause.
Right. I think I really do trust the woman who's in charge of the CDC now, with Dr. Walensky. And I don't know. They're trying to be transparent, which is, of course, a great thing, and saying the truth, which is we don't really know, and so we are kind of flying a little blind here. But I think leadership means, look, this seems to be the best route, and we're going to stick with it. And that doesn't seem to be happening. It's almost like we're tipping over too much in favor of, we don't really know what to do, so you decide. I don't want to be responsible for it. Someone's got to just say, this is what we're doing, and stick with the plan. I hope that we continue to do the two shots.
Well, to some degree, Rosemary, hasn't that happened in that they're taking the Johnson & Johnson off when they found even the smallest of results? And then you get Dr. Walensky and Dr. Fauci and the others checking in? Question mark.
Right.
Yeah, that's a really hard one. I mean, because I do favor transparency, I certainly want to be told about it, but it will do, I think, big harm to their program to get more people in bearing their arms.
All right. Mike, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, no, I think we should follow the science. And currently the science is that we know that if you get it within 2 or 3 weeks after your first shot, you can be fully vaccinated and have the most protection. You don't want to leave people in limbo while other people are getting halfway there and others are halfway there, et cetera, et cetera. Until there's data that says that's more effective in knocking this virus down and knocking down the epidemic and pandemic, until there's data that says that, I agree with Rosemary. You should stay the course, but look for more data, make decisions, and pivot when it's necessary based on the data.
And it's fascinating because there isn't much data, because all of these tests, because it was, and I don't use this word negatively, but it was rushed for emergency, rightfully so, to get as many people vaccinated as quickly as possible. But all of the testing was done with 3 to 4 week windows. So We don't really know what happens at 8 or 12 weeks yet, definitively, except for what is being done in Britain. And as Rosemary rightfully points out, they certainly had their share of problems. I don't know if they're exactly the gold standard in this. JP.
I'm surprised that they don't think about a different approach for old people versus young people. You know, young people, there are tens of millions of young people that haven't yet gotten a vaccine. And why not give them all their first dose, which will make them, I think the science is that they'll have 52% immunity and potentially prevent them from dying or being hospitalized if they get the virus. And a different approach for people that are more susceptible to actually dying from the disease, people that are 60, 70, and 80. It is obviously a tough thing for one of these doctors, Walensky or Fauci, to go out and put their name on a new strategy. I'm surprised there isn't a different approach for young people versus old people. Young people are less at risk. The data shows that they're less at risk for actually dying from the disease.
We'll work on getting Dr. Fagan on in the next day or two and try to talk about some of these questions with a doctor. But as this news breaks, it is interesting. A lot of people writing in about the J&J vaccine. And they say, "Welp, you guys have ruined my day. I was getting ready to sign up and was
hopeful. Don't ruin my day.
I would get J&J. I don't have the time to do two shots." Well, just to point this out, Nancy, we didn't take away the shot. It was the U.S. government that decided to put it on pause. But I know you heard it from us, but we were not the ones that said, please don't give Nancy a shot.
And a similar letter, Joe, comes to us from Leslie, who says, "It is very disheartening to hear the level of hysteria on the program this morning. Nothing is without risk. You have a greater chance of getting killed while driving. How will we ever get past this if we can't maintain level heads?" Leslie, again, we're just reading the news.
That's right. I mean, so I think JP makes an excellent point earlier when he said, we know of six cases now. As this story becomes the top story, you can be damn sure that there's going to be many, many more accounts. And we're going to be watching it more closely, right?
Right.
All right. One or two more letters, and then we'll go to a break, and we'll come back and move on to other things. Do you think the U.S. tried to steer the above-referenced vaccine AstraZeneca to poorer countries or Asian Muslim countries? My son runs a small business in Kuala Lumpur. He is a U.S. citizen, stating to me that AstraZeneca vaccine is being pushed on that part of the world. Not a poor country at all, but no one will offer themselves to this vaccine. He could fly back here to get a vaccine. This means a lot of people all over the world will not get vaccinated unless they are offered Pfizer or Moderna.
Well, it is an interesting question, all right. I think, did I read Mexico yesterday? We were sending large groups of our available AstraZeneca to Mexico, and I think somebody said there, we don't want it. Government official, you know. Yeah. Do I have that wrong?
I've just come back from Eastern Europe where there's no vaccine and people were driving into other countries from Bosnia, for example, into Serbia in order to get AstraZeneca. They were happy to get anything. So I guess it's a marketing thing, isn't it? Like if you're hysterical for any vaccine at all, AstraZeneca doesn't seem as dangerous as it does to us, for whom there are riches of vaccines. Three. Mm. Right.
I think it's interesting. A lot of people are making this case in our letters of saying, look, this one from Jim, six cases in 7 million shots, ? AstraZeneca is similar, roughly one case in a million. Let's compare this to the birth control pill, which I've heard is 40 to 100 times more likely to cause blood clots if taken. No one is taking the pill off the market. The benefits far outweigh the risks. Yeah, let's look into it, for example. But what were the health profiles of those who got the clots and warned those likely to be more at risk? But don't stop vaccinating with the J&J vaccine. And maybe this is my naivete, and we'll pause here after this, but maybe this is my naivete. But you would assume, right, Alan, that if the U.S. government is putting a third of their vaccination program on hold, that there is a concern that perhaps we should heed?
Yeah, well, I would think that. I was interested in the last letter because we had another letter about estrogen and increasing risk. I have no idea whether it's true. I just want to say that. And therefore, that it may in fact be tied to the birth control issue. And that could be a big fat lie in itself.
All right. Let's take a break. When we come back, we will continue. We'll get to other issues as well. We welcome your comments. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back right after this. So one of the things that seems to be a common thread in the stories and the many stories about coronavirus that we've been talking about just this morning is the conundrum factor of what do you do? And in some cases, damned if you do and damned if you don't. I would like to go to the case, which I find fascinating as well. And that comes out of the state of Michigan. The Biden administration and Michigan's Democratic governor are locked in an increasingly tense standoff over the state's worst in the nation coronavirus outbreak. Their numbers are highest as of this moment, with a top federal health official on Monday urging the governor to lock down her state. While the governor has been willing to do this prior, she is not now. Gretchen Whitmer publicly called again for a surge of vaccine supply. The director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said at a White House news conference that securing extra doses was not the most immediate or practical solution to the outbreak. She said that Michigan, whose metro areas include 16 of the 17 worst outbreaks in the nation, needed to enact shutdown measures to stamp out the crush of infections. Michigan's outbreak, driven by a highly infectious virus variant, loosened restrictions, travel, youth sporting events, and uneven compliance with the remaining rules, is by far the worst in the country. The state is averaging 7 times as many cases each day as it was in late February, and hospitalizations have roughly doubled in the past 2 weeks. Nonetheless, Ms. Whitmer, has stopped well short of the far-reaching shutdowns that made her a political lightning rod last summer, with armed protesters storming the state house to demand an end to coronavirus restrictions. So, Alan, does this not become political?
Well, it is political, of course, because governors are politicians, and they have to know what is ticking off the people who could or couldn't vote for them, would or wouldn't vote for them. Every governor has this problem now. People want everything opened up like it used to be. And I know there are lots of people who are in that situation. So they look at their polls and they say, oh, boy. And now the other side of that one is they know what's right and they know what the right thing to do for their people. If the only way to do it is shut down, then you really have to shut down, as she is demonstrating that she's wavering on this for a good reason. She wants to be a successful politician.
What is it when you are, though, a Democrat and one that has, you know, has certainly aligned with the Biden administration and is now in this war of words, as I said in the New York Times, saying that it's becoming increasingly tense, because they're saying, look, the CDC and the Biden administration saying, you got 16 to 17 of the worst problems in the country. You need to do something. And before we give you more vaccines, you need to get it under control. Mike, what do you think?
I don't think that's exactly what Walensky is saying. I think what she's saying is the quickest, fastest way to deal with this is to do more shutdowns and to take steps to mitigate the spread of the virus. I mean, if you think about it, if they got a lot more vaccination availability, it would still take 2 to 4 weeks before it would begin to even have an effect. You can have an effect right now by keeping people from spreading it to each other. But I know why Whitmer doesn't want to do it. You got to remember, she's the one that the wacko groups wanted to kidnap and put on trial.
Right.
I mean, she's facing a very, very hostile segment of her society, and it's a lot easier to say, just give me more vaccine, and in 10 weeks, we'll see the result of it. And Walensky is saying, do something now. I don't think she said, we're not going to give you more vaccine until you do it. She's just saying, that's not the immediate solution. You're going to continue to get vaccine.
But you know, Walensky isn't the only one. Andrew Cuomo has the same problem. You know, he wants to open things. He wants more people to be allowed to go to weddings. He knows his popularity is at an all-time low right now. And he's another one. And I don't think it's... Go ahead. I'm sorry.
You know, I agree with you. I mean, and yesterday I heard the governor Cuomo say on WAMC saying that, you know, he's going to allow certain size graduation gatherings, sure, even though it'd be better to do it another way, because people are really tired of this and they really want this. But what I think the message should be is it's been a year or more. We've learned how to behave, how to safely get together in limited ways. And we need to continue that. We're adapting to this rapidly spreading virus, and we're continuing to get everybody vaccinated so that it goes away. But until then, I mean, you know, we haven't stopped eating. Society hasn't stopped working. You know, it's just that we are adjusting and gradually getting back to normal, a new normal, by taking the steps that we know now work to hold down the spread of the virus.
I want to go to Rosemary, but I want to...
I'm sorry, I'm on the side of the governors. I'm totally on the side of the governors on this. You know, New York and Michigan are not Iran. So why are we saying first, before we talk, you have to do this? We have the supplies of vaccine, or else we wouldn't have had the debate we just did about giving it to first timers instead of to people who need a second dose. Send it to New York and Michigan. There are scientific reasons to doing that. They do have enormous outbreaks. Send it to them. Biden is doing a terrible job, it seems to me, with his so-called Democratic allies. He has got to do a better job being kinder to the Democratic states. He's continuing in some ways the Trump administration policy of belittling and cutting back on help to blue states. It should be the opposite. I don't see the problem.
So, Rosemary and Mike, I want to read, this is the quote from Dr. Rochelle Walensky, head of the CDC, and this is what she said. The answer is not necessarily to give vaccine. The answer is that to really close things down, to go back to our basics, to go back to where we were last spring, last summer, and to shut things down. Do you agree with that, Rosemary?
No, I don't think that politically she can say that. I think that Biden and whoever is powerful enough to do it needs to intervene and say, we're sending you the vaccines. Now we're going to talk about shutting down. It's before we do this, then you have to do that. It's just the way we're negotiating with Iran. It's the whole position is wrong.
I also think it's important to think about this as a forced government shutdown. Is it effective? And, you know, this virus has been around for a year. Everybody's very well educated on it. You know, is there some semblance of personal responsibility where if you really want to, you can avoid catching the virus? You can double mask. You can stay away from people. And is it the job of the government to shut down the state and to tell people you can't go outside, you can't operate your business and all that? Or is there after a year some semblance of, you know, we all know the risks. You should all act accordingly, according to your own risk profile.
So JP, if people die because they're stupid and they don't wear the masks.
That happens all the time. People die all the time because they're stupid.
I get it. Yeah. I get it. But we have laws, for example, driver's licenses and other things, which we do to keep people from crashing into each other. We say, first you have to get a test, then you have to do this and that. So, you know, I think that this thing is up to everybody. Doesn't really quite work out the way that some people think it will.
I agree, Alan. It can't just be that everybody decides for themselves what they're going to do and how they're going to respond, because they need guidance, they need regulations, they need some restrictions as to how they gather and what goes on. Because some people are stupid, but the stupid people may not die, but they might give it to somebody vulnerable who's trying to avoid this, but are, just incidentally exposed to the virus. And that's the trouble here.
So I read
That's been the situation for the past year. That's been the entire situation. And the restrictions, especially in Michigan, have not worked. Instead, it's developed into this whole I'm free and you can't make me kind of attitude. So especially in Michigan, what JP says holds.
Well, Rosemary, do we know how well they've worked. In other words, we know that they've got more than they should be handling. Nevertheless, it could be worse if there were no restrictions. Am I wrong about that?
I don't think that JP was talking about no guidance and not restrictions, although businesses can certainly make their own restrictions based on personal choice. I'm not sure that we'd be any worse off.
So let me read this one line, and then we'll go to a break. But this is the line from the New York Times article on this. The Biden administration, however, has held fast to distributing vaccines by state population, not by triage, shying away from anything that could look like inequitable distribution or political favoritism at a time when vaccine supply remains tight in many places.
Absolutely.
What say you, Rosemary?
That should be stopped. That should be stopped. Absolutely. And it, on both counts, it is favoritism if you want, because it's the Democratic administration giving to Democrats. But Michigan and New York legitimately do deserve more vaccine right now. They have huge, terrible outbreaks. So send it. You can defend it.
Well, if I think it's about saving lives, why wouldn't you send more vaccines to where there's more cases? If our goal is to save lives, why wouldn't you triage and send to the states that have the most cases?
But
I don't understand why you wouldn't.
But not necessarily, because they're blue states. That's very important.
Jen Psaki said we don't pick by.
If Texas gets a spike, you send them more vaccines.
Fair enough.
Jen Psaki said yesterday it's important to understand how we've approached vaccine distribution from the beginning. It's done with equity in mind. It's done with the adult population in mind. We don't pick by our friends. We don't pick through a political prism.
Yeah, but I don't think that means she can't that the government can't. You know, triage essentially, and throw water where the fire is burning the hottest. I agree. I think their fear is that if they start doing that, they're going to erode public confidence that it is fair, and they're going to make people angry. And people are already really angry. They're really trying to manage this as a public policy, and it ain't easy.
With that, let's take a break. We'll pause there at It Ain't Easy, and we'll take a break. We'll come back. We've got some announcements. Ray Graff will do news, and when we come back, we'll continue. We have much more to discuss. we have like 8 stories, and I haven't even gotten to the ones that I sent to the group last night, so we have meant much to discuss. We'll do that right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Mike Spain, and the Empire Report's J.P. Miller. All right. Let's just have a couple letters I want to read, and then we'll move on to other things very quickly. We go to those letters. Sean says, in the WAMC listening area and in New York, vaccine supply isn't the biggest challenge. If you search for slots for a local pharmacy, you can get a Moderna shot perhaps as soon as tomorrow. We now have enough vaccine for all the arms showing up. The big challenge is getting people to sign up for those shots, which is a good point in midst of our conversation. We then go to Stephen, who says vaccines are distributed by population. The immediate answer is to have Michigan shut down. That would have effect now, not 5 weeks from now. That is from Steve. Keep Michigan open is what Michelle says. Governor Whitmer needs to keep Michigan open. We're in the middle of a cultural germ warfare. Those who refuse to comply with COVID fighting measures are about to hold the rest of us hostage. Step up vaccinations, Governor Whitmer. Everyone who wants one should get one as protection from COVID and from those who would expose their neighbors to sickness, ignorance, and rage. The Fed should support her in this fight by giving her a deluge of vaccines right now. And I don't think I said Michelle, but I think it's Michelle, M-I-C-H-E-I-L.
Is it a woman or man? It might be a spelling of Michael.
I don't know. I don't know, but it's M-I-C-H-E-I-L, and I'm sorry if I butchered your name, which I probably did. Okay.
Me too.
Amy said, in regard to the most recent surge in Michigan, Governor Whitmer is asking for more vaccine to help with her most recent surge. Why doesn't she clamp down more, mandating more closures? I believe she would love to do this. Unfortunately, the Michigan legislature has tied her hands and limited her emergency powers to temporarily close things down. Michiganders throughout the state are defiantly refusing to wear masks and distance in many places. People feel their rights are being trampled. Pandemic be damned. I've lived there for many years and still have friends and family there, and they share stories about this behavior all the time. Then we go to this one, and Tony says, I fear disagreeing with Rosemary, but I think the prudent and scientific responsible thing to do is continue the fair rollout of vaccines and use mitigation where we know there are outbreaks. We can't keep shifting the supply from state to state, chasing the outbreaks. That from Tony. All right, let's go to some other stories. And we begin, I obviously want to talk about what's going on in Minnesota. So we go from Michigan to Minnesota. There's three big stories coming out of there, and I'm going to merge them all together if you don't mind. The big part of this is we talked about this, the shooting that happened over the weekend in Brooklyn Center, which is about 10 miles from where the Derek Chauvin trial is taking place, the man who is up on murder charges of George Floyd. Hours after body camera footage of the killing was released, protesters gathered outside the Brooklyn Center police station despite a new curfew for much of the Twin Cities. In what is just an amazing, amazing in the sense that it was stunning when the police officer, the police chief, announced this yesterday, that the officer who fatally shot a black man during a traffic stop near Minneapolis mistakenly confused her gun for her taser. They quickly released video as they tried to ease tensions in a state on edge over the Derek Chauvin trial. In a brief clip of body camera video, officers from the Brooklyn Center Police Department can be seen trying to handcuff the driver, Dante Wright, before he suddenly lurches back into his car. One of the officers aims a weapon at Mr. Wright and shouts, "Taser, taser, taser." She fires one round. Mr. Wright groans in pain. She says, "Holy blank, I just shot him." The officer can be heard shouting. Late Monday, the officer who fired the fatal shot was identified and had worked for the department for 26 years. So, my goodness. Alan?
Well, I've said it before, I'll say it again. When a doctor walks into an emergency room and has to do a heart procedure or operation, we don't say it's okay if you make a mistake every once in a while. People do, but we don't say it. We find it intolerable. We find this is an intolerable situation, that I supposedly reached for my gun, for my taser, it wasn't there. Instead, there's a lot of testimonial to this already. And the idea that this was a mistake is, to me, intolerable. We can't allow mistakes there. She may be a wonderful police officer. She may be a wonderful, 26-year veteran, something like that, on the force. Nevertheless, there has to be an immediate and absolute reaction to killing somebody when you didn't have to.
So the two things that I learned yesterday during the press conference, Mike, one was that the reason for shouting taser, taser, taser is to alert the other officers that that is the weapon that you are discharging. I think it can be presumed then that she believed at that time that she was going for the taser. With that said, officers will have a taser on one side, and this from the police chief, will have a taser on one side and a gun on the other. the placement of that is not mandated except for your dominant hand, the hand. So if you're right-handed, it would be your right hand. That's where the gun is, and then the taser is on the other side. So your dominant hand is where the gun is. Your non-dominant hand is where the taser is. And that is supposed to alleviate much of the confusion in discharging the wrong weapon. Did I get that sort of right, Mike?
Yeah, you are correct. I went and looked up a picture. You know, it's all over the internet, pictures of handguns versus taser gun. And they look a lot alike. I suspect they feel a lot alike. They're easy to manipulate and fire and aim and fire. And I suppose that's for the reason you want a police officer to be accurate when they have to discharge a weapon, whichever weapon it is. It happens a lot, though. I mean, I can remember it happening in other stories. And one of the stories I read last night says it happens fairly regularly where officers are under a lot of stress. They get confused. I'm willing to believe that this officer really just messed up. And that's better than just wantonly shooting and killing someone intentionally because they were, you know, eluding police, I guess. But this guy, this poor man, has no recourse. Duante, he's 20 years old. Duante Wright. I mean, he doesn't get a second chance here. It's like George Floyd. You know, the police are, maybe they're arguing that Chauvin made a mistake. We'll talk about that. That's hard to believe. But at least he's getting, exposed to the due process. Floyd isn't getting that. Duante Wright is not getting due process. And that's the most repugnant thing about this. The mistakes, like you said, Alan, you know, mistakes do happen in medicine. But boy, they're not tolerable, and there's a lot of accountability when they do happen, and they're exposed. Yeah,
Rosemary, I know we lost you for a while there, but you're back. What do you make of this?
Yes, I don't know what you're talking about. You lost me for a while.
I'm sorry. We're talking about. I didn't know how long you had been back. My apologies. We were having some technical problems. We're talking about the case in Brooklyn Center in Minnesota, and the officer who mistook the her taser for her gun and
her
used the gun
for a gun.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so first of all, she should have been fired. That's a mistake. That's not acceptable.
Absolutely.
Second, something that has to be done. I mean, along with reform, this is not the first gun pulled mistakenly by an officer thinking they had a taser. Obviously, this is something that should have been fixed long ago. I know the police chief talked about how you put your gun on your dominant hand side and your taser on the opposite. That doesn't work, apparently. And boy, I think that they should be named. If it truly was an accident, I think the officer needs to be named and, as I said, fired.
They were named. They have been named.
They were not immediately, though.
No, just named late last night. But you're right. Yes.
Just now. Yeah. And I please do not take this to say that I very much recognize the difference in grief between the family that lost a beautiful young man. The pictures are just heartbreaking. He should never have been injured, much less killed because of the offenses, whether it was the air freshener or an expired plate. I'm sorry, neither one of those are capital cases. What happened to the idea that just because you commit a crime, you know, you're not supposed to be killed for it, at least right away, and not by the police? So I definitely think that's the dominant case, but I can't help but feel sorry for those police who just screwed up, big, huge screw-up for which there should be consequences, and at a worse time I cannot imagine, and in a worse place.
You know, and
just a big, horrible mess.
And JP, one of the things that adds to this mess, of course, is that even as that explanation came out from police of saying that it was a mistake in using a gun instead of a taser, immediately people, well, all over, but certainly within the Minneapolis area, said, okay, but why were you tasering him in the first place? And even was that justified?
Good point.
Yeah, why was that justified? I mean, you can see from the body cam footage, they were trying to get him out of the car. He lurched back into the car. And that is at the time that she moved around to the left-hand side of the other two officers closer to the door and called Taser. But your thoughts, JP?
I watched the video and was heartbroken about it. And I'm not an expert on police protocol, but when viewing the video, I also thought, why are they tasering this individual? And also, how did they allow him to get back into the car? There were a number of police officers. How did they let him get back into the car? And the other thing I thought as I was watching the video is, how would this have been handled 10 years ago before police body cameras? How would this have been handled 20 years ago without police body cameras? And seeing the pictures of that kid, that kid doesn't get the opportunity to see his 21st birthday. It's a tragedy. And I echo and agree with everything that Mike and Rosemary and Alan said.
I've been looking this up, and
Can I just add one more thing? Because we've talked about this before and in connection with the Chauvin case. And again, it points out that individual police actions are bad. Chauvin should be held accountable. But it's police procedures and protocol. What makes them so holy and sacrosanct? There's really something wrong with this. The use of tasers is overdone, should not ever be used on a traffic stop, even if the guy did have warrants out. They were misdemeanor warrants, and he's dead because of a mistake involving police procedures. So, again, the calls for police reform more than overdue, and we need to be looking at everything.
So here's a journalist question, which is, after he got shot, he was able to move the vehicle and then crashed and then was pronounced dead at the scene. So we assume that he died of the gunshot, but I guess that is something that is still in question, correct?
No,
yeah,
there'll
be
a ruled a homicide.
Yeah. Well, has it been
out.
Ruled a homicide?
Yeah, yes, yeah. It has.
Mm. Yeah, yes.
Mm. Okay. So,
so
he died
in a car accident.
So he died of the gun.
And
they
we
know,
don't
that,
know
he,
that he was.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at that video, you don't know that he was able to. He was falling back into the seat when he shot. It could have been the weight of him with his foot on the gas pedal,
yeah.
And that car just went and
right.
smashed into something. I'm not
right.
sure that was actual driving.
Okay. So, as I said, there's many aspects of the story. The other one, of course, is what we've been talking about. This happens at, as Rosemary said, just the worst possible time, because it adds to the anger and the stakes as the Chauvin trial reaches an end. The prosecution wrapped up their case yesterday. The trial is working its way to its conclusion. Final arguments in the case are expected next week. And while all of this happening, authorities are trying to quell the unrest in the streets after Duante Wright's death. So I'm not asking the question of whether one will impact the other as far as the outcome of the trial, but you do have to ask what would I don't know, I think it's chilling to even consider of what would happen if he is found not guilty. Chauvin,
well,
that is.
Well, if he's either found not guilty or if there's a mistrial because of one voter or not a mistrial or a hung jury,
yep.
I'm assuming there's going to be all hell to pay. We know that when Floyd died, there was around the entire country and in international places, too, where people were protesting it. So I'm assuming that that's a given.
Right. But you think of the powder keg that this was going to be already, and then on top of it, you have this mm-hmm. case, too. Mike?
Yeah, I agree with you, Joe. I mean, had this case never happened with Duante Wright, people were poised to be ready to protest and ready to object if Derek Chauvin is not found guilty of real homicide, of murder in this case. It's so compelling. And yet, we've all seen the the way that this whole thing is unfolding in that Minneapolis courtroom, where the defense is just planting a tiny little seed of an alternate narrative that they'll obviously use when they do their defense and their summation, that will not even come close to contradicting the mounting evidence and the compelling video and the expert testimony. But yet it might convince, as Alan was saying, one juror not, you know, to be on the fence and afraid to, you know, police officers put their life on the line for us every day, and they certainly do. And some people just do not want to find them guilty when they commit acts like this, just for reasons I don't understand. I don't know where the accountability is. But if one person does that, it's going to be a hung jury. There can be another trial, and there certainly would be another trial.
Yeah.
But it's still going to inflame what is now already more inflamed because of what happened 10 miles away. This was 10 miles away from where this trial is going on.
JP?
So I think that one of the
okay.
problems with...
Oh, all right, let's
no,
do
I'm sorry.
JP and then Rosemary. Go ahead.
I jumped in, and I shouldn't have.
That's fine.
Okay.
Go ahead, JP.
I just happened to catch part of Mr. Floyd's brother's testimony yesterday where he didn't talk about the crime. He just talked about his brother and how much he loved him and what a great guy he was. I have to imagine that if there's a case where it looks to me like an open and shut guilty case. I haven't watched all the testimony, but it certainly seems like this guy should be found guilty, and I hope he is.
All right. Rosemary,
yeah,
I'm sorry.
And then I know Rosemary.
Thank you. Yeah, we are reminding me of the Saturday Night Live sketch about the Chauvin trial that they aired this weekend, where the white newscasters are saying, "Oh, it's open and shut. I think we can all agree he's guilty. The jury is going to find him guilty." And then the black broadcasters are saying, maybe not, because we've had other. Yeah, we've had other open and shut cases where the testimony and the heartfelt emotion had no effect and they walked.
Yeah.
And in fact, I think that aside from the loss of life, the death of this Mr. Wright, the second terrible effect it will have is that it actually is a boon to the defense. How do you know? I think that the whole decision about not sequestering the jury, the judge was afraid that that would make them feel like their lives were endangered. How do we know that seeing the coverage of riots and shooting and deaths at night and protesting aren't giving that same impact to them? I think that there's actually a real appeal to be made here that the jury acted in fear of outside consequences and not in connection with whether they thought he was really guilty or not. So I think that's another horrible negative effect of this second death.
Alan?
Do you guys think that there's there'll be an understanding in that jury itself about not the question of guilt, but the question of consequences of either way?
Well, and to Rosemary's point, I mean, it's hard to think of anyone who isn't sequestered of going home and not knowing that this is happening on the streets of where you live.
Mm-hmm, right.
You know, 10 miles away and perhaps even closer, depending on where the people are from.
One of the jurors is exactly from the place where it happened,
right,
too. So,
yeah.
I mean, if you're not sequestered or if you are sequestered, the question of danger and consequences, which should have nothing to do with a fair trial in the United States, is going to play a big role. And you can be sure that this will be on the appeals.
Mike, anything?
Yeah, it would be in the appeal. I think that if Chauvin is found guilty, as I do hope he is, one of the appeal paths would be that the judge should have sequestered the jury and this affected them. And it's a tough question. Do you think the jury knows the magnitude of and the weight of the decision they make and that should supersede the evidence? I don't think so, but I think I think they can't block that from their mind. It's like saying, you know, pretend you never heard that. Of course it's
right
in your mind, the importance of this.
Alan?
No, I just kept thinking of the brother's testimony. You know, he wasn't a witness, but he wanted to tell everybody how important his brother was to him. There certainly is a sociology question here as to as to what the prosecutors are trying to prove or not.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll wrap up. We have much more to discuss. We will do that in our next break. We have Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Mike Spain, and J.P. Miller on the program this morning. We welcome your letters. We ask that you keep them short and to the point, and you can do all of that by simply writing to us, panel@wamc.org. We will hear news from the BBC, and then we'll be back for our last go-around. Again, we welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. We'll continue after this short break. All right. As I said, there are just a ton of stories to talk about, and I don't really want to leave, although we're doing pretty good, I must say. We're getting to a lot of them, so bless you all. Let's go to this story from the New York Times, which I think is interesting when people write about where you live. So there is an article by three reporters in the New York Times today. Here's the headline, Bond Girl Talk and Groping, Albany's Toxic Culture for Women. As allegations against Governor Andrew Cuomo put a new spotlight on sexual misconduct in New York's capital, numerous women there described an enduring predatory and misogynistic environment. And again, three reporters working on this story. And it is troubling. There's no question about it. As one, a former state legislative aide says in the article, there are all of these patterns that we just keep seeing over and over again. You could definitely look at Albany and say nothing has changed. A legislative aide in New York State Capitol grabbed the thigh of a lobbyist so hard at a fundraiser that he left finger-shaped bruises on her skin. A top official at a state agency projected a picture of a colleague in a bikini for all to see in a meeting she was attending. Another lobbyist described a legislator touching her thighs and feeling her chest in the state assembly office. And a state senator said a male colleague told her she looked like a Bond girl as they sat near each other in the chamber. Rosemary, I'm interested in what you make of the climate, but I'm also very, very interested in what you make of the story itself.
What do you mean that they did the story? I think that they're using the opportunity of the governor's discomfort and the accusations against him to look at the picture in a wider context. And I think that that's really good journalism. He did not act in a climate that that punished him. And so I've already talked about his upbringing, which I think has always been privileged and feels entitled. And this is the result of it. This is what women have. This is nothing new to the women of the world. We have known this since we came of age. It's like the black talk, then this is the woman talk, you know, that you are going to be subject to sexual harassment. And you have to deal with it, and it's on you. Don't dress provocatively. You kind of be one of the boys and joke along. And I think it's amazing and wonderful that now we're talking about it and there's reporting about it, and maybe it will change. The men should not be acting, and feel free to say these things. They just should not.
I agree entirely, of course. What I find interesting, though, is so you're sort of, you're looking at it as Albany, and I'm wondering, would any other capital city fare any differently if this reporting team went to look at the culture of the place?
I don't know. Maybe we'll see people in other places doing it. That would be great. I'm actually surprised. I thought things maybe had improved after Clarence Thomas, and that was decades ago. So the news peg is Albany because of Andrew Cuomo.
Right. Alan?
Well, I think
the way news works.
I think your question, first of all, I agree with everything Rosemary said. You know, I've been around here for a long time. We've seen it come and we've seen it go. It is something that I think will create a change. But there is something called the Bear Mountain Compact, and we all know about it. We've all been writing about it for years and hearing about it. You know, as soon as the train goes past Bear Mountain, you know, everything is on, and you can't talk about it. So People are talking about it now. They've been talking about it for quite a while. We've gone through Mark Allen Siegel and the accusations that were there, as Libby mentioned the other day on the air. And it is something that we just have to all pay careful attention to, and I mean all.
So this is the unofficial agreement among members of the New York State Legislature, in which basically what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. So what happens in the state capitol, such as extramarital affairs and other embarrassing behavior, stays in Albany.
You know, there have been many legislators over the years who have had, ongoing sexual affairs with members of their staff and have been hired for that reason. It's been an open secret who they were, whether they were renting an apartment together and they were doing all of that. And some of them were extraordinarily powerful, powerful people. And it's something that that just permeated the whole institution. But my point was, when I was talking about the Bear Mountain Compact, is, you know, it perhaps if it were closer to home, if the Capitol were closer to home, and I've always believed, by the way, I always get hell when I say this, that the capital of New York State ought to be New York City, because that's where everybody is. That's where the population is. And I remember when Jerry Jennings was mayor, and I said it on the television. Boy, did I get...
I bet you did.
You know, but I think that might make a big difference.
Mike Spain, you have covered this city and its politics for a long time. What do you make of such reporting?
Well, it's not new that this kind of sexually charged politics goes on in Albany. What is ironic to me is that the very people that are passing laws that, outlaw and punish sexual harassment and are progressive in many ways are the very people who are many of the very people who are committing it. Even though it is consensual in many cases, it is powerful people. And when it's powerful people preying on less powerful people, that consent becomes a bit gray. And the good news is that it's not being tolerated now. I suspect it goes on in other state capitals, especially like Lansing, Michigan, which isn't Detroit, or Olympia, Washington, which isn't Seattle. And there's a lot of Sacramento, California, which isn't L.A. or San Francisco. It's very common to have a smaller city away from the big cities as the capital. That's not the issue. The issue is that a whole generation, I mean, it's the culture of Washington, D.C. for so long. You need professional standards that prohibits, staff interacting. They should leave and go work for somebody else when these relationships happen. It's much more appropriate. And it's just maybe now newer, younger women are taking office, and that's a good thing because they're not standing for it. And we'll see a good change, I hope.
JP, right under the words Empire Report to the immediate left is this story. What do you make of it?
Yeah, the front page of the New York Times today certainly is going to be talked about throughout Albany, and some questions. First of all, I agree with everything that the other panelists have said. I think that the senator is going to be asked soon who called her a Bond girl, so that will be interesting. You know, that Senate current, I believe she said former senator, is right now unnamed, and we'll see if she ends up naming who it was. And then the second thing in the story that I found interesting is that, you know, the so-called police in Albany are JCOPE, the Joint Committee on Public Ethics. And if you read Mike's old paper, the Albany Times Union, JCOPE is notorious for being an ineffective police organization in Albany. And will there be a reform of that commission as a result of what's happened over the last few months, not only with the governor, but also with this news story today?
Well, it certainly is interesting. And I want to also go to a couple more stories here in our remaining 4 minutes. Rosemary, you mentioned the story a moment ago Well, I say a moment ago. It may have been like an hour ago, but you mentioned it, so I'm going to I'll throw it to you. After nuclear site blackout, thunder from Iran, and silence from the U.S., the Americans and Israelis have worked together in the past to impede Iran's nuclear ambitions, but the U.S. denies that that was the case in the latest sabotage. What do you make of this story? This seems to be a huge story that perhaps many of us aren't paying enough attention to.
Yeah, I have been trying to read as much as I can about it because I think that is the case. We're kind of, as usual, U.S.-centric and ignoring this. But we're trying to reopen the talks with Iran to control and contain their nuclear ambitions. I don't think that we're going to be able to bully them and sanction them into compliance. Trump tried that and hurt. And he didn't succeed and also hurt the chance of ever getting a good deal again. And now this, I think the Israelis are absolutely against it. I totally see their hand all over this. I have to say that we are making it easier for the hardliners to win power again in Iran. And by we, I mean the United States and our allies who don't want any kind of detente with Iran. I think it's such a dangerous game because they will get weapons otherwise. They have got to be talked economically into giving them up. And we were on the way to that under Kerry and Obama, and we have lost so much ground. It's one of the many problems that Biden is faced with. How do you win back trust and confidence? We broke that treaty. Mm. Iran did not violate it. We did. So how do you come back from that, especially if your ally is sabotaging? And we've done it. They've done it before. So why would Iran not think it was Israel? Why would they not?
Alan.
Well, first of all, Iran are hardly school children, and they have done some really despicable things around the world. We know that. But I agree with Rosemary. I do understand that the Israelis think that the Iranians are capable of using their might one way or another against Israel. I don't live in Israel, therefore I'm not making up my mind. However, so I understand where they are coming from. I don't like it. I think Rosemary's right. We were on the right track. And until you catch them at it, the right thing to do is to stick with the game that you had established.
Mike Spain.
Yeah, there's some suggestion that the U.S. was in on it, on this activity with Israel, but I really doubt it. Had it happened during Trump's administration, sure, I think you could assume that. But it really stifles the efforts, as Rosemary so effectively pointed out, to the Biden administration to get things going. And the fact that our own defense secretary was in Israel when this happened, it just makes it look like Israel was trying to ruin the U.S.'s opportunity to try to reopen these negotiations. And that's really regrettable, because I think the only way to work our way through all this is to encourage dialogue between enemies and try to mitigate the tension that's going on. And this does not do any of that.
JP.
Iran's stated goal is the destruction of Israel, and it's hard, I think, to negotiate with a country where their goal is to destroy their neighbor Israel. If you went into the negotiation, you said, hey, we know you have this goal. What can we do to get you off that goal? Is there anything we can do? And they're going to say, no, that's always going to be our goal, is the destruction of Israel. It's a tough thing to negotiate with a crowd like that.
All right. We are just about out of time, but we have 2 minutes. And I'm going to take the opportunity, because if we get to this story, we will have gotten to every story today. And we never do that. So I figured, hey, what the hell? Let's talk about it. And that is about infrastructure. And the president has said he is willing to negotiate with Republicans on infrastructure. The president hopes to whip up support for a package that could eclipse $2 trillion. We'll do a quick lightning round with the group. Alan, how likely do you think it is for the president to negotiate and to negotiate so that it actually can pass?
Oh, yes. He'll negotiate. I don't have any doubt about it. He's got a lot of stuff in there. It's chock full of all kinds of things. I think most Americans agree that the bridges and the roads and stuff come first, and you could do some of the other stuff later on. So he puts a good deal of stuff out there. He says he'll negotiate. I know he'll negotiate. The question is, will they be the party of no, which they've been looking over their shoulders at Trump, who is saying anybody who votes for anything for this guy is on my S list.
Rosemary.
Yes, he will get something through, but it will be a skinny version of what he has out. It won't be nearly as ambitious. And negotiating will consist of a lot of screaming and yelling, and then behind the scenes, negotiating on the old traditional kind of infrastructure. I don't see much hope for the more progressive and the most exciting parts of this bill getting through. He doesn't even have Democrats on his side on that.
JP.
I agree with Rosemary. It's going to be a skinny down version.
And Mike, I'll give you the last 24 seconds.
Yeah, it's a lot in a $2 trillion bill that could be used to persuade a lot, some Republicans to go along with it who really need it in their home states. So it'll get bipartisan support, but it won't be $2 trillion.
Great group this morning. A lot covered. I thank you very much all. Alan, good to see you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Rosemary, Mike, and JP, thank you. Coming up next, the Congressional Corner on WAMC.